You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 23rd, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me here tonight are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello.
Perry DeAngelis.
Right.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Good evening, everyone.
Hey.
What's up, Steve? How you doing,
What's up, man?
We've got some follow-up from last week. The first follow-up is the story of the water-spouting tree. If you recall, in San Antonio, Texas, there was a red oak that had a continual little stream of water coming out of a hole in the side of the tree. The property owners and a lot of the locals were moved to believe that this water was miracle water, and they were drinking it, hoping it was going to possess healing powers. Well, the mystery is a mystery no longer.
So?
The city officials did a couple of tests. First, they just tested the water, and they found that it contained chlorine residue that is identical to the chlorine in the city water.
Surprise!
Just wait a minute here.
They also found, by the way, that it was loaded with bacteria and probably not terribly safe miracle water to be drinking. Also discovered, they did a little experiment, they shut the valve on a pipe that was feeding a sink and a shed in the back of the yard, and the tree stopped spouting water.
Oh, wow, a water pipe. Whoever would have guessed that? I mean, surely not me on last week's podcast. No way could I have solved that mystery.
So apparently the tree, one of the roots of the tree penetrated the water pipe, and the water, being under pressure, as it is in pipes, worked its way up through the tree and out the side.
So this nasty-ass water that's pouring out of the tree that pictures of the people who live there, like they showed one lady like drinking out of it, like a water fountain, and then they showed the other guy like bottling it. Pretty much everyone who drank that got dysentery.
Rubbing it into their wounds to heal them, sure.
Actually, it's not nearly as bad as what happened recently in India, where it turns out that a creek that was salty water suddenly turned fresh, and people took it as a miracle and started saying that the water was healing water, so they flocked to it by the thousands, drank it, and it turns out that it's one of the most polluted creeks in the world. They dump, you know, thousands of tons of raw sewage into the thing every day, and
beautiful,
yeah, and possibly through an increase in pollution, or it could have been due to recent rain flooding the creek. It temporarily lost its salinity. And the salinity is back now, but thousands of people have bottled the water and taken it home to their families. And
good.
Police officials are still trying to get people to stop drinking it.
Rebecca, snake oil is alive and well in this world.
Thank God my skepticism has saved me from miracles.
So this family, though, with the tree, nobody noticed that the sink in the shack stopped working or was greatly diminished?
I guess it's little used.
The real miracle here is that nobody died from drinking that crap.
Yeah.
Give them time.
Well, one more mystery solved by science.
That pesky science.
And yet, we solve one mystery and another one crops up, this time in Turner, Maine. A curious beast, while chasing a cat, was struck by a car and killed and found along the side of the road. Now, this creature, many locals believed, has been menacing local pets for a couple of years. It is charged with killing a Rottweiler and a Doberman Pinscher in the last couple of years. Some of the locals that saw it said, and I quote, "It was evil, evil looking, and it had a horrible stench I will never forget."
Jay, did you go to Maine?
Yeah, so this... The local resident says, "I've lived in Maine my whole life, and I've never seen anything like it." Well, there's a couple of pictures of this. You know, obviously, we'll link to it on the notes page. And you know, the creature looks a little odd, especially its head is a little oddly shaped. But you know, you look at the whole thing, and it's basically
bizarre.
A dog. But it's basically a dog.
Yeah, it is. But the head is definitely striking. It's really...
It's kind of creepy looking.
Yeah, it's creepy. The snout is definitely really short. But, you know, it's no mutated freakazoid animal that, you know, is unexplainable. It's, and they explain
it's
it.
It's a canine.
It's definitely a canine. It might have been a half-breed with a coyote or something.
You're clearly missing what's going on here. What's happening here is that the mystery creature in Maine obviously was drinking from the water coming out of the tree.
Ah, there you go.
It mutated it. It went back up to Maine and started killing everybody's pets.
It's a good theory. You should write a book about that.
Now, they were doing DNA analysis. That they said that's back, Bob?
Yeah, it says right here, the DNA analysis showed the animal was a rare wolf-dog hybrid. Case closed.
Yeah.
Who would have possibly guessed?
Go figure.
You know, I believe that test was paid for by a newspaper. The Maine state, the wardens, they wouldn't even come down and look at it.
Yeah, they weren't
interested. They wouldn't even bother.
Another hybrid? Who cares? Okay, well, that's two mysteries down.
I'm sure the photo will be on our webpage. Take a look at it. You know, it's a dog.
It's right. It's a dog.
I mean, please.
Might be a funky dog, but it's a dog.
It's a funky dog. You know, it's a canine. End of story.
There were two creationism stories in the news this week. The first one is nothing new, really, but there is a TV special featuring that noted scientist Ann Coulter that is attempting to make a direct link between Darwin and Hitler. This is the new Christian Broadcasting TV special.
Oh, I bet they didn't even know each other.
Blamed Darwin for Hitler. Now, this is nothing new. Creationists have been doing this for a while, and this goes back to eugenics. You know, the Nazis did have this notion about something about a superior race and killing off the inferior races, and, you know, and through that selection evolving, you know, the purebred Aryan race. Or a superior race. But that had nothing to do with evolution or Darwinism. They were just borrowing the science of the time in order to, you know, give a patina of science to their ideology. But their ideology did not have its roots in evolution.
You know, I think, didn't Saddam Hussein use chemistry to kill a bunch of people?
Right.
So, should we really be teaching that in schools? I don't think so.
Well, plumbing is obviously evil now, too, since that tree was spouting evil water, you know.
Right. Steve, the show is, I've discovered two fallacies, two logical fallacies. There's appeal to consequences.
Mm-hmm. The argument from final consequences, yeah.
Yeah, so if you accept Darwin, then you're going to end up like Hitler. And then there's also guilt by association, you know. Obviously, that's another good one. Ann Coulter is actually going to be a guest on the show, and one of her quotes regarding this was, she said Hitler was applying Darwinism. He thought the Aryans were the fittest, and he was just hurrying natural selection along. Actually, Hitler's racism was based on the view that races were created distinct by God.
Right.
You know, there's just because somebody's misusing a scientific theory doesn't invalidate the theory. And there's also the point that Hitler, there's no record, as far as I can tell, that Hitler ever mentioned Darwin.
No.
And of course, he never evinced any, you know, understanding of evolutionary theory. I mean, it's pure baloney.
The historical record is pretty clear that racism, you know, existed before Darwin. And in fact, if you read the justifications for slavery, etc., it all invokes the fact that God created the races separate and created the white race superior to the black race. It was an ideological view. People used whatever was accepted at the time to justify these beliefs. And it says nothing about the underlying belief itself. And if the creationists really want to go that way, that means they're adding another logical fallacy, which is inconsistency, because they're not applying it to the religious arguments for racism that were made before Darwin. So they actually get a trifecta of logical fallacies in there.
Who'd have thunk it?
But this, you know, they've been saying this for 50 years. That's nothing new. The other creationism item that caught my attention this week has to do with federal funding, of course, in the United States, for science grants. Now, these are grants that are called SMART grants, and they are given in the area of technology, mathematics, and science. And there's a list of eligible studies. These are grants worth of...
It was created by Congress.
It was created by Congress.
This year also. Right. And as you said, it's called the Smart Grants for the... I have here for the National Science and Mathematics Access to Retain Talent Program.
Right. They had a list of subjects that were eligible. And curiously, in the most recent classification scheme, evolution is missing. And not only is it conspicuously absent from the list of sciences eligible for the grant, there is a gap in the numeric sequence where evolution should be, as if it were there and specifically removed. Not, in other words, it's not an oversight. It was a specific decision to remove it from the list. The suspicion is that for political reasons, whatever congressmen were in charge of this decided that either evolution was too controversial or they just did not decide that it was worthy of government support.
Though we should note that that hasn't been proven, and they're still not sure. They haven't got any solid answers from the
committee. Well, yeah, they couldn't get anyone to comment from the Department of Education, but a spokeswoman did say that she suspected that the absence of evolutionary biology was a clerical consolidation of some kind, and that evolution might fall under other topics. So that's what we have right now.
Really?
That's BS.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Let's face it. Which is, it's interesting because this is a program specifically designed to retain talent by funding talented science and technology researchers. In fact, the United States has been losing in the natural sciences and evolutionary biology to Europe and other countries, specifically because we don't support the evolutionary sciences as much as we do other ones. And this is a very concrete example of that. So it's a self-reinforcing cultural phenomenon. You know, we don't support it. The public doesn't believe it. We don't teach it. We don't grow as many scientists who are interested in it. And this is how sciences wither. You know, they wither through this specific kind of neglect.
This whole thing is mind-blowing to me. First off, is this issue coming from what the people want, or is this issue prompted by politicians?
I mean, it's both, right?
It seems to me to be both. It seems to me that the politicians are just reacting to what they think is going to be the latest and greatest.
I mean, is creationism really that powerful of a movement?
Well, you know, Perry, right now, the president of the United States, his official statement is the jury is still out. He doesn't confirm or deny whether or not he believes in evolution. But we know he doesn't because he's born again.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, at last year's amazing meeting in Las Vegas, Murray Gell-Mann gave a great speech about, he's been through countless presidents and served on so many science advisory boards, and he gave a really amazing speech about how things have changed from the 60s until now, and how the present administration just has absolutely no respect for science at all. You know, you do have to kind of worry about what Steve was talking about, where, you know, they're not going to fund it, and it's only going to make matters worse.
Yeah, the problem is, though, there's no bright stars on the horizon, you know, at least not in the foreseeable future. There's no champions of science out there running in either party.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
There really aren't. Granted, Republicans are generally quite a bit more religious and therefore even more anti-science. I will grant that.
Perry, but still, I think you should run for president. I think we could set up a good campaign.
Rebecca, I'm going to tell you right now, no.
too many skeletons in my closet.
I think our listeners might rally around this.
We'll see. There'll be a grassroots movement. I do have to say that we do come off often on this podcast as being a bit doom and gloom, and that's because, you know, we're strongly dedicated to science. It's very frustrating to confront, you know, popular attacks against science, we're motivated for whatever reason. But I remain optimistic. I think that despite all of this, the institution of science has weathered it quite well, and there remains a strong and consistent public support for science. I think even among, you know, religious types or New Age types, Except the fringe with a really, really wacky and unrealistic philosophy. But the vast majority of Americans realize, and of people, I think, in general realize, that science works. You know, it delivers the goods. And even if they might have some bizarre philosophy, nobody really in their heart of hearts wants it to go away. And they still are. Everyone still hopes that science will be there chugging away in the background and churning out all of the sexy technologies and solving, you know, our healthcare problems and our energy problems and making our life better. So for that reason, I don't think that science as an institution really is at risk. But having said that, short-term damage to specific sciences can certainly be done, and they can have, you know, long-term consequences. Eventually, it'll recover, you know, but it's a matter of the, you know, wasted resources, wasted effort, you know, losing the cutting edge. Those issues definitely are very real.
Not only that, you know, my attitude is like, you know, screw eventually. I mean, chances are we are going to know people that are going to die that if we had a robust stem cell research programs going, maybe they wouldn't have died.
That's right.
Yeah, Bob, eight years, poof, gone, thanks to George Bush.
Imagine what we could have contributed. I mean,
yeah, 8 years is a very long time in science. Steve, do you, earlier you just said that people say we have a gloom and doom perspective on the show, and I don't really see it that way. I mean, I think we're bringing out a lot of negative things, a lot of things that are controversial, because that's the point to this show. But, you know, this isn't a feel-good show, so in the idea that we're talking about hot topics, things that trouble us, things that we find compelling for good and bad reasons. This isn't like a show where we talk about all the cool latest technology and all our favorite sciences.
It's true. We tend to talk about the bizarre claims, the controversial claims, and, you know, because we are cast in the role of skeptics, our role tends to be that of the naysayer. But in reality, where we're all coming from is that is a very positive outlook. We love science, and we're very positive and optimistic about how science works, about the power of science intellectually as an idea and practically as a technology. And we have to always keep in mind that we need to spend, you know, as much time talking about how wonderful science is and capturing, as Carl Sagan, I think, did better than anyone else, the awe of science, and not just, you know, talking about how silly and ridiculous all of these controversial claims are. Speaking of the awe of science, let's turn a bit to astronomy, one of my favorite disciplines. Last week, we spoke about the hubbub in Prague, with all of the bickering among the scientists at the International Astronomical Union, trying to decide how to define a planet. This was one of the science or fiction topics. Well, they've been fighting all week. We're recording this on Wednesday. By the time you are listening to this podcast, what we're saying will probably already be decided. In fact, they're probably going to announce some kind of decision on Thursday. So the two options for how to classify a planet seem to come down to this. Either a planet is defined as an object that is at least a certain size, has enough gravity to pull itself into a sphere, and revolves about the sun. If with that classification, then Pluto would remain a planet, but also three other objects in our solar system would be promoted to that of a planet. Ceres, and the other objects that have been tentatively designated, Xena and Sedna. That would bring the number of planets up to 12. And Ceres is actually now an asteroid in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. So there actually be a new planet between Mars and Jupiter, and then the other two planets will be beyond Pluto.
Did you know that? I wasn't aware that Ceres was actually classified as a planet for a while.
Yeah, in the 1800s.
I wasn't aware of that.
Then it got demoted. That's one. And under one proposal, it would be promoted to a planet again, and Pluto would remain a planet. It'd be two others. We'd have 12 planets. The alternate proposal adds another criteria, that not only does it have to be big enough to be a sphere, but it also has to gravitationally dominate its local neighborhood. And the reason why some astronomers are passionate about that criteria is because that derives from our understanding of how solar systems evolve and how planets form. True planets form by the accretion, gravitational accretion of objects in their local neighborhood. Pseudo planets never accrete, or they're just big chunks of rock, you know, that or whatever that are left over from the early solar system, and they don't want just large objects, you know, that didn't really form as planets to have the same designation as quote unquote true planets. Under that system, Pluto would get demoted, and we would be reduced to 8 planets in the solar system.
Wow,
those are the two options.
So, Steve, let's say that Pluto collected more mass for some reason. And let's say that Pluto started to have, you know, a molten core and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing is really just a matter of size. But the reason why Pluto would get demoted is because it has a moon, a quote-unquote moon, Charon, Charon, that is almost as big as it is. And it is not really dominating the gravity of its local region. It's just one of many similar-sized objects out there in the Kuiper Belt. That's primary. And same thing with Ceres. Ceres is just one asteroid in a belt of asteroids. It's not really dominating that orbit. It's sharing that orbit with lots of other chunks of rock. It just happens to be the biggest one. So that's why those things would not be planets.
Which way do you think they're going to go?
I don't know. I really, really don't know. But it seems like we're either going to go to 8 planets or 12, but under neither proposal will we be sticking with 9 planets.
Which way would you go if you had a vote, Steve?
I don't know. I think my head says 8, my heart says 12, because I would hate to demote Pluto, but I understand.
You're a skeptic.
I understand the purity of the definition, so I'd probably in the end vote for the 8 planets.
How about you, Bob?
I think going down 8, I think it really... I like that. I like the inclusion of that new criteria that, you know, where you've got to dominate your area, and, you know,
it makes sense.
And Pluto crosses Neptune's orbit and all that stuff, and it does make sense. It'd be tough to see Pluto go, but I wanted them to use the term for objects like Pluto. I liked Pluton.
Plutons.
I liked it, but apparently from this article, from an informal show of hands, it was not popular, along with Plutoid and Plutonoid and Plutid. So Pluton's looks like it's out the window, and I kind of like that one. An homage to the name Pluto.
If they demote Pluto, then Pluto and the other three worlds will probably be referred to as dwarf planets. They may also be called planetoids.
Planetoids is popular.
They'll have some designation of their own that has the word planet in it, but they're not full or true planets.
It might be the way to go. I mean, it's really possible if we decided to get rid of that last criteria and include our number up to 12. I mean, we could have conceivably in the next 10-20 years, it could have gone up to 20 or 30.
Yeah.
I'm in favor of expanding the definition to just call everything a planet. Why not? It's just a word. It's such a silly.
That sounds like another
thing.
Rebecca, just stop right there. Yeah, come on.
I have to disagree. And the point of that the scientists who want to demote Pluto is that it's not just a word. It actually reflects our understanding of the origin and nature of planets. So it's not totally arbitrary.
It's, Rebecca, you obviously don't understand men. When you say things like that.
Oh, is that where you're going
it's
with that
very,
one?
It's very important to us that we nitpick about things like that.
Planets and tools. Don't mess with them.
Oh, okay. I had no idea that planets had suddenly become a man thing.
Well, let's move on to email. We do have a guest coming up shortly. In a few minutes, we'll be interviewing Larry Sarner about therapeutic touch and attachment therapy. But before that, we're going to do a couple of emails. There were two emails that were a follow-up on the discussion of acupuncture from last week, so I'm going to just talk about those two emails. The first one comes from Alex in New Jersey, USA, and they write, "Hello, first I want to thank you guys for such an excellent job with the podcast. I discovered it a few months ago, and I'm in love. I think my husband is getting jealous. Your podcast is such a breath of fresh air."
You should probably just stop right there.
Yeah,
Steve.
We could stop. Right
Move
there.
On to the next okay. email.
But I'll continue nonetheless. She writes, I am an MD-PhD student, and as medical students, we are taught not to challenge patients' ideas about their health, but to work with them and incorporate their beliefs into the standard medical care. The idea is to make sure they do not abandon you as their doctor altogether for an alternative practitioner. As much as it hurts my skeptical sensibilities, I can't entirely disagree with this approach, nor can I come up with a better alternative. So healthcare professionals are left to perpetuate all kinds of unscientific nonsense or to lose your patient, thus jeopardizing their health. Today, I ran across an article about acupuncture. I'll give the link. And she basically wants to know what I think about the article. This is an article. This was published recently, looking at acupuncture in the treatment of fibromyalgia. Well, Alex, let me do the first question first. This is actually something that I deal directly with because I teach, you know, medical students, residents, fellows, and I also lecture to my fellow physicians on this very topic. So at all levels of medical education, this is a very difficult issue. But I think that there are better options out there, and I'll tell you my personal approach and what I recommend when I discuss it. I don't think that as physicians, we have to give tacit approval or validation to pseudoscientific methodologies because we're afraid to, quote-unquote, confront the patient. I think
Or lose them.
In fact, I don't think that those are the only two options. What I do is I tell patients flat out what the evidence shows. If they ask me about acupuncture, of course, I never, you know, will challenge or ridicule their personal beliefs. Certainly, it's not our place to in any way attack their faith. I would never, and I don't bring up what my faith is, and I don't discuss what their faith is. They express it fine. I smile and go on with the conversation. And I certainly would never seem judgmental. You know, the physician-patient relationship requires that the physician is a non-judgmental, you know, individual in that relationship. But what I do, if they bring up an alternative modality, we don't have to just say, well, just accept it, or say I don't know about that, or, you know, whatever you think helps. I could say, listen, I've investigated acupuncture or whatever, or homeopathy or whatever it is that you're interested in. I've looked at the scientific evidence, and the studies published do not support it for this indication. In fact, the evidence shows that it does not work. And if there's other problems too, I'll say that as well. You know, there really isn't. You know, scientists have looked, and no one's been able to demonstrate a plausible mechanism. My experience to that is that patients respond very positively to that. As long as you're talking about logic and evidence, which is basically what they expect you as a physician to do, and you have given the topic enough consideration that you actually looked at the published evidence. You're not dismissing it out of hand. You're not ridiculing. You're not rolling your eyes. You're saying, that's a good question. I looked at the evidence, and this is what I found. I'm a scientific practitioner, and as a physician, this is what I would recommend. This would be my professional recommendation to you. You don't tell them, you know, browbeat them and tell them this is what they have to do. You just give your professional recommendation. That way you do not have to, to any degree, compromise your professionalism or your dedication to science or evidence, and you still can fulfill that physician-patient relationship. In terms of the second part of the question regarding that specific study, like a lot of the acupuncture studies, this study had some methodological problems, not the least of which is the subject matter. Fibromyalgia is a very controversial disease that is difficult to diagnose. It is controversial to the point that there are those who reasonably believe it is not a real diagnosis. There may be a real diagnosis at the core, but if there is, it is hugely over and misdiagnosed. For example, I think a lot of people who are diagnosed with fibromyalgia simply have sleep deprivation, and that manifests with physical symptoms. So that's a huge problem for this study. Yeah, it's one study, and you cannot look at something like acupuncture and draw any conclusions from a single study. You have to look at the hundreds of studies that have been published, and you have to see, can they establish an effect with replication, you know, in the same model to a sufficient degree to establish that there's a real effect there, and that has not been done. what we see are single studies that are positive and then follow-up studies that are negative, or you get contradicting data. The meta-analyses have all been negative so far. So you have to put this in the context of the broader acupuncture research. So far, there is not compelling evidence that there is a reliably measurable effect from acupuncture. And this study, you know, especially because of the problems that it has, does not add significantly to the full body of the literature. We got another email on acupuncture from last week. This one comes from Tom Barbalay, and he included a description of how to pronounce his last name, which I appreciate. Tom writes, "Long-time listener, first-time emailer. I heard in podcast 56, Dr. Novella state that, in quotes, Asians have a much higher pain threshold. Can you please provide a reference for that? Many thanks." And I actually went back and forth with Tom a few emails discussing this issue, and it illustrated to me that I needed to clarify, you know, what I was actually talking about, because that was a fairly offhand comment on my part. You know, these chats are very unscripted. This is not like writing an article where you can choose every word very carefully. And my words were not chosen well in that statement. What I was referring to was the fact that the way medicine is practiced in those parts of the world where acupuncture originated and originally thrived has some significant differences from the way it is practiced in the West. Specifically, there are many procedures which are done in Korea, for example, or in other Southeast Asian countries, where in the United States we would use sedation and anesthesia, and in those countries they do not. You know, the patients tolerate those procedures with less or with no sedation, which I think is relevant to the whole issue of, you know, the alleged cases of acupuncture anesthesia in these cultures. Part of it, I think, is due to what is a fairly well-documented cultural phenomenon that in these societies there is a much greater acquiescence to authority than there is in some Western cultures.
So, Steve, do you think there's a genetic component to it as well?
That's very interesting. And, you know, and part of this discussion with Tom, I did look at to see what, just to, you know, familiarize myself more with what is actually published. And there is a research program looking at genetic differences in the experience of pain. And, in fact, there are differences. If anything, however, Asians have a lower pain threshold genetically. They seem to report and experience more pain than Caucasians.
Tong. Very painful.
You know, it's interesting, but doesn't affect the impact of that anecdote of a patient essentially under acupuncture anesthesia complaining that he is in pain over and over again, and the surgeon yelling at him to shut up, and the patient shutting up and just nail-biting it through the surgery. I can't imagine that happening in this country. All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Larry Sarner. Larry, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you for having me.
Larry is a mathematician by training, but works as a skeptical consultant and has written articles and been active on issues such as therapeutic touch, attachment therapy, naturopathy, and the anti-fluoridation movement. He's the author of the book Attachment Therapy on Trial, The Torture and Death of Candace Newmaker, a member of the National Council Against Health Fraud, and an official with Advocates for Children in Therapy. And also, you have, Larry, a couple of relatives who are very active, including Emily Rosa, who famously at 11, I believe she was 11 at the time, was involved with a fairly, what is now famous and in some people's opinions, definitive study of therapeutic touch. And you were involved with that trial with her, is that correct?
Oh, yes, very much so.
So why don't you talk about that? Tell us about that study that Emily and you did and what the response was within the therapeutic touch community.
Okay, and I also don't want to forget Emily's mother, Linda Rosa.
Of course.
Who was actually the lead author on the JAMA publication of the results. Essentially, the reason it is often referred to as the definitive study on therapeutic touch is because, unfortunately for therapeutic touch practitioners, there have been almost no studies of any quality or, and certainly none on any fundamental level, to look into the practice of therapeutic touch. And I'll take just a moment to describe what therapeutic touch is, was, or was supposed to be. It essentially was an update of the old notion of laying on of hands. Nursing professor, actually, by the name of Dolores Krieger, came up with the idea that what healing actually consists of, which is the old vitalistic notion that actually health and life and vitality is all the result of, in modern terminology, energy fields that exist around body of any living animal. And that illness is actually a disruption in those fields in some form or fashion. The idea behind TT was that you could get in and manipulate the fields in such a way as to restore whatever balance is has been disrupted in these fields, and good health follows from that. The problem was that the actual ability to detect this field, not to mention the existence of this field, has been quite elusive over the years. So at one point, Emily, who was looking at the time for a fourth grade, her first science fair project, happened to notice Linda looking at some videos of practitioners of TT and wondered aloud whether or not they could actually do what they claimed. That led to some discussion and eventually an experiment where she took a cardboard barrier, a towel to prevent, as she put it, peeking, had found some practitioners in this area to just simply put their hands out and let Emily hover her hand over one of them and let them tell her, from being able to detect her field, which hand she happened to have her hand over. The hypothesis was that their detection of Emily's hand would be on a random basis, that the field doesn't actually exist, and that they can't really detect such a field, even if it did exist. So we did some statistical analysis on the results, did it in a couple of rounds a year apart, and as a consequence discovered that it was really indeed quite random.
Now, Larry, I think the question everybody is wondering right now is, did she win the science fair?
That comes up from time to time, and there were no winners at the science fair.
Oh.
Her school was one of those that said, you get recognition for participating, but not actually for competing. However, later on, she did another science fair experiment, not quite as dramatic, where she did compete and went and won her division all the way up at the state science fair.
But
for this particular one, no, she didn't. Fame came from the publication of the results in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA.
I guess that'll have to be good enough.
Yeah, that's accolades enough being published in JAMA. But I think part of the reason why this study gets so much attention, especially in skeptical circles, is because it is an elegant study of the most fundamental premise of therapeutic touch, which is that there is a human energy field and it can be felt and manipulated by practitioners. Something with which the proponents of therapeutic touch never bothered to test themselves. And in such a simple way, essentially pulled the carpet out from under an entire, pseudoscientific discipline. And it was just iconic that it was done by an 11-year-old girl. I mean, as if it weren't plain enough that disproving the premises of therapeutic touch were child's play,
Indeed. And often the thought was that somehow her parents, Linda and I, had put her up to it. that we had actually been responsible for this, and that really that makes Emily just a little angry from time to time when that comes up, because it really was her idea, and not only her idea to test it, but her idea as to what the test would be. Why didn't that occur to these people well before they had made TT grow into such a phenomenon at the time? It has waned as a phenomenon since Emily's publication, but up to that moment, they were all convinced that it could be done. Those who were doing it were convinced they were actually doing something. Even the ones that took Emily's test were convinced that they had actually felt her energy field at the time, and that they were capable of feeling it.
And did she get an immediate reaction from those practitioners that she tested? Like after the results were
right, that's what I was going to ask. Were any minds changed on their end?
No. In fact, I just saw an ad in the local New Age healing magazine from one of those practitioners still offering it. Of course, now she's not offering therapeutic touch. She's offering healing touch. They changed nomenclature, but pretty much it's the same thing. They even had a picture of someone supposedly doing it, and it resembled the TT of old. The reactions at the time were generally of relief on the part of the practitioners. Most of them were worried that, oh gosh, they might only get one or two out of ten, and that would really show that they didn't know what they were doing. We had one that expressed a special relief that she got five.
Wow.
She thought that was pretty good.
Well, thought that was, that's a relief. I mean, you know, it wasn't stellar performance even in her view, but it wasn't really, really bad.
She thought that was better than average.
Yeah, what are the odds of that?
And that was actually the reaction all of us there had to somewhat bite our lips. Five was as bad as you could get, really.
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, the average was 4.4 out of 10. That turned out statistically to come out right where one would expect for just guessing.
Right, and there was no subset that did better. There was no, if you broke it down by the years of experience of the practitioner, they did no better than the apparent novices. So no matter how you looked at that data, it was negative.
Yeah, there was no correlation. And since we were producing a negative result, we also needed to look at the power of the test. Power of the test suggested that if there had actually been an effect going on there, it would have been only one chance out of 10,000 that Emily's data would have missed it.
Yeah, but and you said they never bothered to test it beforehand, but even more telling, since then, there like really hasn't been an effort within the therapeutic touch community to replicate that study or to do a similar study. They still are basically happy with the assumption that the human energy field exists and they can manipulate it.
That's true, and it actually goes one step beyond for most of them, which is to dismiss Emily's study as not looking at what's important about therapeutic touch as a complete package, and that is that it actually heals people.
Right.
So what they tried to redefine the problem in terms of we can only believe outcome studies.
Right.
And there were a number of rather visceral reactions on the part of the inventors of therapeutic touch and those who were really pushing it as a movement at the time that this was more or less a stunt on the part of the medical establishment, because it was published in JAMA, and it was not a fair test of any of this. There was a brief attempt when the publication first appeared in 1998 that some wanted to try to do a replication and see if they couldn't get contradictory results. However, it seemed to have fallen through, and nothing, absolutely nothing came of it, at least in terms of publication. They just dropped off the map.
Right, which is a good indication that they weren't able to produce consistent positive results, because you could be sure we would have heard about it if they did.
Right. If they'd had, then that would certainly be the case. We've had a suspicion, however, that they never actually conducted conducted the test, perhaps out of fear that it wouldn't, perhaps out of criticism by others saying, you're going to replicate that stunt.
Right.
And they didn't follow through. Perhaps. We never heard why they didn't publish any results. And no one else has since either.
Yeah. And the other thing that's very telling also is that they dismissed that study after the results were negative. You can be sure if the study were positive, they would gladly accept it as proof of therapeutic touch. And I find that that is generally the case not only within therapeutic touch, but the so-called alternative medicine culture, is that they are hypocritical in that they will accept any apparent supportive evidence of their claims and say, see, it's scientific. But they will dismiss all negative scientific studies by saying, well, that's not a fair test, or this modality cannot be subjected to scientific tests of that kind. But they basically do that ad hoc based upon what's positive and what's negative, not based upon any coherent, you know, theory about what kinds of studies should be possible.
That's certainly been my experience with the alt-med people for some time, and therapeutic touch falls definitely within its realm. They will glom on to anything that indicate support for it, actually regardless of how scientific it may be.
Right.
As long as it comes out positive, that's all that matters. In TT, there were several outcome studies. Most of them turned out to be very, they were very questionable in terms of their protocols and methodology, but also a number of them came back with results that were very questionable. As a consequence of that, most of their conclusions would say, ah, there's something here. This suggests that there needs to be more study.
Right.
And that was the state of affairs when Emily came along with her study and said, let's go back to basics and look at the capability of anyone to do this. And that's something that is missing from alt-med, from thing to thing to thing. There really does need to be a kind of Bayesian look at the possibilities of whether or not this stuff is even reasonable. And that's one of the big concerns we have with the NIH and National Centers for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. They just take whatever is being suggested at face value and say this is worthy of study, without doing a Bayesian or other analysis to say whether this is reasonable enough to put resources behind looking at.
Yeah, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're funding studies that could never get funded through normal channels because they're not meeting the normal criteria of scientific rigor and plausibility and usability. So it's basically just a way of a backdoor way to fund bad science, that you happen to slap this totally arbitrary and meaningless label of complementary and alternative medicine onto. But it doesn't really have a cohesive definition. It's just, you know, whatever is not meeting the normal standards for academic or scientific rigor, we'll call this to create this double standard so we can, you know, slip through the back door things that otherwise shouldn't make it.
Whatever you got the guts to propose.
Yeah.
And it's so foolish. Yeah. Because in the end, the probabilities suggest that there's not going to be anything there.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been the record so far of what we call NICM. What have you really gained except to maybe throw some money at a few people with some wacky ideas? We're talking things that most any trained scientist will look at and say, that is unreasonable to expect that that even has any possibility of working.
Mm-hmm. By the way, what's Emily up to now?
Emily has moved on to college. She's a junior now and at the University of Colorado. She just changed campuses from Boulder to Denver. She's studying psychology.
Larry, a quick question. You mentioned that therapeutic touch kind of waned a little bit after Emily's experiment. How would you characterize that?
I would characterize it as quite significant and large. The main therapeutic touch organization, the one that was founded by Dolores Krieger, is still around. It's been fairly peripatetic. And therapeutic touch itself is kind of passé at this point. I rarely run across anyone who claims to be a therapeutic touch practitioner, where they were all the rage back in 1998.
Right. Now, Larry, more recently you have been involved, you and Linda have both been very involved in attachment therapy. And, of course, this culminated, at least to some degree, in your book, The Torture and Death of Candace Newmaker. Why don't you give our listeners a quick synopsis of that case?
Candace Newmaker was a young 10-year-old child who had been diagnosed by facts, of all things, with a psychological condition, as many adopted children have been, with something called reactive attachment disorder.
Larry, did you say she was diagnosed by facts?
Yes, I did.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, attachment therapy or attachment therapy practitioners are a kind of eclectic lot who have many means of trying to convey their ideas to potential patients or the caretakers for potential patients. They do not have any particular scientific or academic theoretical basis for either what they do or what they believe, and they have a whole set of ideas about what this condition of attachment disorder actually consists of and how it manifests itself or displays itself in terms of signs or symptoms. Very often what is done is you ask the caretaker, many times it's the mother, what does your child do? And you go through a whole series of checklists or questionnaires. And then the evaluation is made not necessarily by ever meeting the child. And that was the case with Candace Newmaker. Her mother had met this one individual who said, after listening to verbal description at a conference of her behavior, said, boy, she sounds like a particularly bad case. Here, take this questionnaire, fill it out, send it to me by fax when you get back from the conference. And that's exactly what happened. She was diagnosed as having this problem. It rang true with the mother. One recommendation led to another, and she came to Attachment Therapy Central, the epicenter for all of this worldwide, which just happens to be here in Colorado. She was put through what's called a two-week intensive, where they spend a lot of time trying to make this child believe certain things about herself, her mother, now adopted mother, her biological parents, and so forth, and a fairly rigorous regimen of exercise, behavioral control, what many people would characterize as brainwashing techniques of various types. She went through about 10 days of this. On the last day, or the next to last day, she was beginning to what psychologists identify as dissociation. Her mind was getting to the point where she just could not reconcile what was happening to her and with her inability to affect or control the outcome of events that she was experiencing. And so they decided to have a nice, easy day with her the following day, and they came up with a little psychodrama where they would pretend that she was in the womb and she was going to be reborn to her adoptive mother. They held this little session. They wrapped her up in some flannel sheets and told her to find her way out, something that a real baby doesn't do. But in her case, she was supposed to struggle and find her way out. Well, she couldn't do it, and she kept complaining that she was having difficulty breathing, but none of the five adults in the room believed her for a moment. Eventually, in spite of all other sorts of signs that she was indeed telling the truth, she eventually fell silent. 20 minutes later, they finally deigned to open a flannel sheet, and they found her blue. They were able to briefly get her breathing again, but were not actually able to revive her. She was kept alive, biologically alive, until the next day, and then she died. It turned out that attachment therapy was something much broader that had been going on, but none of us around here anyway, including my wife and myself, had ever heard of such a thing until this case had come about.
And the basic concept here was that she had to be born again so that she could then start with a blank slate and form the attachments that she never formed during her biological childhood.
Supposedly, the problem for her, and this was actually a problem for the attachment therapist as well, is that she had perfectly well attached to her biological parents. She was not removed from mm-hmm. their home until she was 5 years old, and she was really removed for neglect, not abuse. The rebirthing, which is what it's come to be known in the general public, was actually just a script for that day's attachment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea behind attachment therapy is to somehow establish a bond between an adoptive parent and an adoptive child.
Were there prosecutions in this outrage?
There, fortunately, very much there was, and it actually set a very important precedent. The two lead therapists on this were convicted of homicide violation. It was reckless child abuse resulting in death, which carried with it a minimum sentence of 16 years in prison. They were convicted almost a year to the day after Candace was killed. We assisted the prosecution, Linda and myself and even Emily, in helping them to understand what these people were like and what they were doing, why they were doing it, and attempting to, we helped find experts to testify at the trial for the prosecution. They were sentenced to 16 years. Each, and was sentenced to the minimum. I believe they're up for parole next year.
Wow. Mm. You know, this story is eerily similar to what we hear, and we talked about this on a podcast recently, what we hear about exorcisms. Do you see that kind of parallel between their blind adherence to this therapy compared to the way others might do so for religion?
In my opinion, I'm seeing a lot of correlations with various cultish aspects of the way that attachment therapy, attachment therapists, and attachment therapy parents organize themselves. Attachment therapy is, forgive the characterization, but I don't know a shorthand way of doing so other than say it's a rather brutal child-directed activity, even though attachment itself, the relationship, they don't treat the relationships truly, although sometimes they talk about doing so. They actually treat the child. They put all responsibility for the failure of the relationship to be the child's fault. So they make an effort change the child, who's the least person in this relationship, this failing relationship, to actually be able to understand what to do to make the relationship work. But nevertheless, that's the way they focus. They place all problems that the child exhibits, that those problems are rooted in their malattachment to their caregiver. Things that are required of the caregiver to force the child to do what the child is expected to do becomes a 24/7 job on the part of the caregivers. Not to mention taking them for treatment week in and week out for years, where the same thing just keeps going on. So that as a result, you've got a family unit that becomes quite insular. It is so withdrawn trying to deal with these problems with one or more children. Very often they identify more than one child or even deliberately bring in children they think have this problem into the unit. And they are told by the therapists or leaders of the movement that they need to cut off contact with people who do not accept the things that they're doing. At some point, this is all they know and all they do.
Right. It does become a cult, and it's focused on...
Right out of the cult handbook.
Yeah, the apparent or the self-proclaimed skill and knowledge and intuition or whatever of the practitioner, of the counselor in this case. Basically, what they've done is they've completely made this up. They reject all of the established professionalism and ethics of counseling and psychology and psychotherapy. They engage in directly physically as well as emotionally and mentally abusive behavior. And they're fairly arrogant and indignant about it as well, even to the point where a dramatic case such as this isn't enough to convince the most the strongest adherents. Even now, the two practitioners in this case, I mean, as far as you know, I have read about this case, they were never repentant. I mean, they still thought they were doing the right thing.
Which is what helped convict them. It's an attitude I call the arrogance of ignorance. Mm-hmm. They are so convinced that they know what's going on. They will not vary from it and or accept any kind of evidence, even of their own eyes, that suggests that they're wrong. In the trial, for example, the lead therapist, Connell Watkins, at some point was asked, he says, well, what do you think killed Candace Newmaker if you didn't? And she responded and says, I don't know what killed Candace Newmaker. She was convinced she could breathe through that flannel sheet, so she must have been breathing through that flannel sheet.
Right, and the dictum that healthcare professionals should hold supreme of first do no harm is cast aside, partly because they don't really have, they're not professionals. You know, they're really just playing at a very serious game of healthcare. When they don't have the credentials or the training or the professionalism or the ethics to really know what they're doing, which is true of a lot of alternative medicine. Although in this case, in the case of attachment therapy, there is a direct physical harm component to what they're doing. Most of the stuff we look at, like therapeutic touch, say what you will about it, it's at worst it's worthless, but it's literally doing nothing to the person. They're just waving their hands over, you know, over the subject. There's no direct physical harm component, but
perhaps keeping them from real therapy, Steve.
Yeah, yes, of course, but that's why I said direct. It's not directly harmful.
Okay.
There's lots
yes.
of indirect harm from all this nonsense. But it's, you know, conceptually and psychologically no different than attachment therapy. It's just more dramatic in these cases because of the direct physical harm component to it.
Larry, do you have any plans at appearing at the parole hearing next year?
We are making our initial contacts to find out just what our options are in that regard. I don't want to reveal principally what we want to say because it might get back to them and they may do something with the knowledge. Mm-hmm. But we would like to. We don't know yet what the procedures are. Maybe in these proceedings, but we're going to try.
Right. Right. Well, Larry, we're out of time, but thanks for joining us. It was a pleasure speaking to you about these very important topics, and we certainly appreciate the work that you and Linda and Emily are doing to try to champion at least a little bit of rationality in your corner of the world.
I hope you're able to speak at that parole hearing, Larry, and help keep those people behind bars where they belong.
Absolutely.
Thank you. We'll give it a try.
Okay. Thanks again. Take care.
Thanks,
Good night, Larry.
Good night.
Thank you.
Well, I think we have time for a science or fiction, so let's go to that now.
It's time for science or fiction.
Every week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious, and I challenge my esteemed skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And of course, you all at home can play along. There's a theme for this week. The theme is weird archaeology. And these are all items that were provided to me by Kenny Fader, from whom we interviewed last week. I asked Ken to tell me the weirdest archaeological facts he could think of.
Basically. Oh, man.
Let's do it.
You guys ready?
Oh, I am.
Yep.
Number one, South American Indians were able to smelt platinum long before the technology was available to reach platinum's melting point of 1,768.9 degrees Celsius, a temperature unattainable until the 19th century. Item number two. Although corn was cultivated in the Americas, it was developed from a grass known only to exist in Asia. Item number three. The sides of the Giza pyramids deviate from a north-south alignment by 3/60ths of a degree. Also, you can refer to that as 3 minutes of arc.
Huh.
Bob, why don't you go first?
Oof, man, this is nasty. Corn from Asia. Oh, man, this is tough. I'm just going to have to just toss a coin here. Smelting platinum, they could have had some funky way to... I'm going to say, okay.
God, come
one.
On.
All right, you happy? One.
Okay, the one is fiction. The South American Indians could smell platinum. Okay, Rebecca, why don't you go?
Yeah, that's where I was leaning to. I mean, if there wasn't any technology for smelting platinum, then they didn't do it, right? I mean, it seems like the sentence itself gives away the answer.
Okay.
I'm going to go with number one.
All right, Perry?
Well, I guess you can melt it in a volcano or something. Or stick it in some lava. What?
Can you call that technology, though?
Well, you know, I guess.
That's a method.
Yeah, okay. They all sound reasonable. I'll go with the pyramids.
Okay.
I'll go with the pyramids.
Jay?
One really smacks me as total crap because this whole smelting process does not seem possible. By American Indians back in the day. I want to vote for it, but I think corn is from the Americas, so I hope I'm right. I'm going to take number two.
Okay. So you all agree. No, I think you guys are all
I was all
split.
Over the board,
so
yeah.
Perry, you said the Giza pyramids was fake.
Yeah.
That one is true. The Giza pyramids deviate only by 3 minutes of arc from a true north-south alignment. They basically used the points of the setting sun and rising sun to align the sides of the pyramids.
That was
kind of the easy one on the list.
I knew that.
let's go next to number two. Corn was indeed cultivated in the Americas exclusively, and it originated from. It started out as a grass called teosinte. Which just had a few scraggly, corn kernels on it. And it took, hundreds or maybe even thousands of years of careful cultivation to turn it into what we now recognize as corn. But teosinte came from the Americas. It did not come from Asia. So that one is fiction.
This is like the first one I got right in how long?
That's right. No, you said that last time.
I can't remember.
Didn't you, Jay?
True.
You've gotten a few right.
It's true.
Good job.
Now,
and number one.
The item
that
Ken sent me that I derived that I kind of just use it as a loose starting point for what I made up as that one, was that in every major civilization throughout the world, people cultivated one major staple crop to live off of. Corn in the Americas, wheat in Europe and Africa, and rice in some parts of Southeast Asia, all of which lack certain amino acids like lysine. And in every area, they also cultivated some other major crop, for example, either beans or barley, that have the missing nutrients that their major crop did not have. So all the peoples of the world basically figured out how to
stay alive.
Yeah, to have a combination of agricultural crops that provided all the things they need nutritionally.
Like rice and beans.
Right. Like rice and beans. Exactly.
Which and number one.
Also, that number one is science. So this was the tricky one. I figured this would get some of you. This is a good example of American Indian ingenuity. They figured out how to smelt platinum, even though they could not achieve its melting point. And they did it in two primary ways. Well, to be technical, they only smelted it in one way. They used it in other ways too, which I'll talk about in a second. But they figured out that they could smelt platinum by mixing it with little silver beads. And by mixing it with silver, it would lower the melting point of the platinum so that they were able to smelt it at a lower temperature.
So is it fair to say that whoever smelt it dealt it?
Somebody had to say
I
that.
I think that's probably the best joke of any podcast ever.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
Rebecca, you're trying too hard. Now, they also developed a process known as sintering, which is still used today. Do any of you know what that is?
Sintering, of course. Heard of it.
Of course. I had to look it up. I had no idea what it was. I had to look it up. Sintering is when you start with the powder of a metal, like, say, gold powder, and then you heat it so that the little flecks of powder melt together, which is not as – you don't have to get as hot as you would to, like, turn it into a liquid or to smelt it. You just heat it enough so it gets sticky and it all sticks together. That's called sintering. And the South American Indians sintered platinum with gold, and they used platinum and gold in, you know, their jewelry, etc. Interestingly, when the Spaniards went to South America, they were primarily interested in, you know, ink and gold. To them, platinum was a contaminant. It was the worthless metal that contaminated and was an impurity in their gold. You know, get this stuff out of here. Hmm. But they brought it back to Europe, and then scientists in Europe realized that, hey, this stuff has some really amazing properties. It doesn't corrode. It's a great conductor. You know, it has a lot of interesting properties. And it's because it's actually much rarer than gold, it became a much more valuable metal.
Cool.
That's awesome.
How about that?
Well, Jay, congratulations on winning this one.
I'm going to have a beer on myself tonight.
And thanks to Ken Fader for providing those the science of fiction for this week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ken.
We have a skeptical puzzle this week. This one is written by Evan. Evan, who's not here with us this week, but he sends in this puzzle. It's a little poem.
A man, a chemist, a pastor by trade, in search of a cure he thought he had made. For the prevention and cure of scurvy, he wrote, his newest discovery, he had hoped to gloat. The public's belief in this product was fast. Dermatitis and rheumatism would be things of the past. As time passed on, and the ills still remained, the product itself would garnish new fame. Still, the pharmacies sold it. It would become a tradition. People bought it by the hundreds, the thousands, and millions. For that man long ago, we must give our thanks. While he tinkered with elements, currents, and plants, and though he did not rid the world of rickets or piles, to billions of people we attribute their smiles. Who was he, and what was his discovery? That's a tip of the hat to Mr. Paul Harvey.
Well, first of all, the poem didn't rhyme all the way.
I was going to point that out, too, but, you know.
The rhyming was a little weak, but, you know, blame Evan.
He's no rapper.
Oh, we will.
All right, how about this? Evan has to rap this. He has to, full on with a drum beat, have to rap this.
Oh,
on
dear
the next
Lord.
Podcast.
You got it.
Okay.
And I hope you'll all be here next week for that podcast.
That's right. Well, that is our show for this week.
There you go.
Thanks again for joining us. It's always a pleasure, guys. Thanks for
being
on the
show.
Thanks, Steve.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other podcasts, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.